Actually, we recycled.
We recycled it.
Oh, yeah.
Wait a minute. So when did cutting down the forest become a bad thing?
Excuse me? Only if it's a class of state forest.
You don't want to go into the Elliott?
Dead and dying trees make good paper. Okay. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. It is Monday, March the 10th, 2003, and at this time I'm going to open up a public hearing, and we'll be discussing at this time Senate Bill 5518. With the tap of the gavel, we'll do that. And this is Housing and Community Services Development, and at this time Rick Olson, Legislative Fiscal Office, will tell us where we're headed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I need to make one correction. The agenda has Senate Bill 5518, and I believe it's House Bill 5029.
Okay. I don't know if we need to tap out of 5518
right,
and open 5029.
Let's do that. And we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 5518, and with the tap of the gavel, we'll also at the same time open House Bill consideration House Bill 5029.
Right.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Just let me ask one of my technical stupid questions. Which one did we advertise?
5029.
Cool.
5029 was posted on the schedule.
Good deal.
Okay.
Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee, this is the budget for the Housing and Community Services Department. I distributed to your offices on Thursday a brief memo with the LFO analysis attached. If you look at the bottom line, the budget is essentially the same as the 2001-03 legislatively approved budget. You will notice that the department's non-limited budget constitutes 84% of the total budget.
Where is that right now?
That should have been delivered to your office.
Oh, well, you're supposed to bring it down.
I got it.
I asked them, they said they didn't have it. Yeah. We have somebody who has their piece.
It's not up there. I didn't bring it down.
I even read it.
This morning. At 6:30. Yeah. Oh, and by the way, I didn't open that as a subcommittee of the subcommittee either. We need to do that.
Yeah, we have rules.
We have rules now. So then we're going to, let's get the script back here again. And I'm going to open the public hearing as a subcommittee of the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. Public hearing on House Bill 5029. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Very good. Thank you.
Again, referring back to the memo that I delivered to your offices, the budget is essentially the same as the 0103 as far as percentages go. The general fund portion finances affordable housing, homeless assistance, emergency housing, and emergency food programs primarily. It also receives other funds and federal funds through grants and specific program allocations. There was one budget note that was included in the 2001-03 budget from the subcommittee that had to do with the Housing Trust Fund and its relationship with Senate Bill 1149, the energy deregulation monies, and how that is used throughout the state. The agency did report to the June 2002 Emergency Board as required by the budget note in regards to how they're meeting the requirements of that note. There was one audit report that was done by Secretary of State. That audit report was issued in December of 2001. You have a copy of the summary of that budget report at the back of your the memo that I delivered. There are no interim reports or studies done. The department appeared before the emergency board on a few occasions to ask for other funds and federal fund limitation increases, and the department will talk about the issues and trends that are affecting the department. That's it.
Very good. I think we have enough here that we are a full committee. Let's open as a full committee. Bob Repine.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Bob Repine. I'm the Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services. I wanted to start out by, first of all, making some disclaimers. I'm going to probably be leaving you around 9:30, quarter to 10, not anything to do with you as a group, but we had a major catastrophe down in southern Oregon last week. One of our facilities that was under construction, a 50-bed facility, blew up. And it was next to a already built construction project that we owned, and it caught that on fire and burnt that to the ground. So I'm going down there. They're having a community meeting at 1 o'clock today, and they're trying to bring all the resource people together to try to pull together so that the people who were displaced will have some certainty in what their future looks like for the next few months. Going into the next couple of years, obviously, it'll take that long to rebuild the building. So I probably won't be with you tomorrow either, but I felt important that I come at least share some opening comments with you this morning before I leave. I'm going to be working off of a crib sheet I think all of you have received. It's a two-pager entitled The Presentation to Ways and Means on the Oregon Housing and Community Services Budget, starting on Monday, March 10th. I hope you've seen it. If you don't, I think we have extra copies. It's a little outline, kind of like the lineup, as it were. Okay, well, they didn't.
No, they didn't.
Okay, all right. Well, maybe it would help, actually, so they'll know what's coming ahead. We'll get you a copy of that now that I told you you had had it. We've taken our agency and we have broken it down for the 2 days to make sub-presentations of people who are responsible for each one of the sections. And I take great pride in the assembly of people who work at the agency. They are leaders in their industry and in their field. And so who not better to speak about the issues that they work on a day-to-day basis are those managers and administrators. So each one of them will be taking on their own programs to answer more specific questions to you. Also, before allegedly, I rumored was that you got a shorthand version. I think I see it out there of this green binder copy. Mr. Olson has one. Representative Krieger has one. This is, just so you'll know, I'm going to be using this for my part of the presentation, and I think many of the members will refer to it. It's kind of the abridged version of the binder, so if you don't really want to go into the binder, it's got kind of the meats and potatoes of the agency in here. And then just so you'll know, what you're seeing around here are some pictures of projects that will be talked about in the next today or tomorrow, describing in detail some of each one of them, how they differ and where they are geographically around the state. And to the chair's information, we went low-tech on these flyers of bulletins. We have actually, because of the budgetary issues, we have a plot printer in our agency that we found out could be converted to do photo work like this. And so instead of going out and spending about $500 more, we were able to do this in-house for probably about $50. So it's not high-grade quality stuff, but you can get the emphasis or the sense of what these projects are. And then just another disclaimer, because I know it has been an issue around the building for this year already, since even the last time. This is a financial report you'll see that you have either received or will be receiving shortly. This is our end-of-the-year financial report that Mr. Olson referred to. I was interested to find out what costs were on that, as I've been around the agency since 1998. When I took over the agency in 1998, that document cost $9,000 to produce. It was, as you would say, a very slick piece. We do this now all inside the building. I make 500 copies of it because we're required for our business in the New York marketplace to have at least financial statements for very sophisticated partners that are looking at our bonds to buy. This run for this year, to the credit of my staff, we printed 500 of these, and it cost $2,700. And so, you know, don't have to make them slits, but they still are marketable at a lesser rate. So, again, we're pleased to be able to show you that we can save resources. Again, starting in this little green stapled flyer that you have, I'm going to be starting in the second blue green page called Agency Overview. Many of you, as being senior members in the Assembly, and some of you being all senior members in the Assembly, except for Senator Morse, I want to go ahead and just give you a recap, a reminder of what the agency does, and particularly our mission statement. We went through a very comprehensive review about the agency's mission as to what it does on and does not do or should not do on behalf of Oregonians. And so in the little box, you'll notice that our mission statement of all agencies should have one, I suspect, but ours is it's framed around the communities of the people who live in there. Our mission is to reach out to create opportunities for partnerships that improve Oregonians' lives and the quality of their communities. We don't talk about housing in our mission statement. We don't talk about our other services. We look of ourselves as a partner who can come to the table to work with the community to see what aspects we can add to both the quality and the character of those lives of those citizens that live in that community. And we found that our new mission statement has fit us very well over the last 2 years. Many of you remember, some of you may not, the agency was founded back in the early 70s. as the housing agency at that time, housing department. It was only about in 1991 that the community service component was added to the agency because of a close working relationship that they found, even though they were not housed in the same agencies. The community service agency was then housed at Department of Human Services, but found on a normal basis those agencies were working on comparable issues on a day-to-day basis, and so it was deemed to be appropriate to move the community service component over to the housing agency, thus in 1991 creating the Oregon Housing and Community Services Department. We are probably, as people ask us, what do we do different than other agencies, we are probably one of the closest working agencies at the community level. We deliver resources to communities with their cooperation, and there goes another picture, and participation. The department has chosen the model of health viable communities and the way to facilitate a better quality of life as our mission for all Oregonians, and particularly for in light of those who have special needs and special populations. That's the family photo down at the bottom. On the reverse page, on the structure of it, we do have a council that is appointed by the governor. Pictured there currently are four of the members. There are two members that are not pictured there because they were recent appointees. But I want to let you know that we have diverse representation around the state. Our chair is Nancy Pope Schlangen. She's from Bend, Oregon. Buzz Ortiz is from Sandy, Oregon. Paul Kohlberg is from Coos Bay. Larry Menninger is from Ashland. Judith Petrie is from Portland. Brady Adams is from Grants Pass. And Stuart Lieberwitz is from Roseburg. All representing different aspects of services and or the activities of what we work in. As an example, Judith Petrie is a service provider for a housing authority. Larry Menninger is a builder. Brady Adams is a banker. Buzz Ortiz is a developer advocate for Latinos. And Paul Kohlberg is a housing authority director. So we have a very diverse group of people to bring our issues at one place and have good open discussions. Again, the group is established by the governor, and they are involved in both the policy and of the agency and advising both us and the governor on policy and local issues relative to the housing environment of the state of Oregon. Again, we'd like to also note at the bottom of that page that we do have also a working relationship by statute with the Community Action Directors of Oregon. These are commonly known as CDOs, or CDs, CAPs. They are private, not-for-profit organizations consisting of the directors of the community action agencies, and they are located in, I think, 30 of the 36 counties in the state of Oregon. Their primary goal, and you'll be hearing from one of their representatives hopefully tomorrow at public testimony, is they have been charged, and they have taken up the charge of anti-poverty issues in the state of Oregon and spend an enormous amount of time working on issues around anti-poverty for the state and their communities. Flipping over to the next page, next topic for you is to, again, give you a brief look at our long-term goals and objectives. We have five long-term goals and objectives that we have developed through our mission and outreach for our opportunities of our programs to the citizens of Oregon. Of those five that were developed, we also have turned those and we wove those into our strategic planning, which also then link in with our performance measures that you'll be hearing about later. Again, below in the five bulleted areas are the five strategic objectives of our agency. I don't have to read them for you. You can read them for yourself. But I'll go through them individually. And just as you can see, as they're listed below, as an example, long-term objective one, become a high-proficient agency. It talks about how we can accomplish that within our agency and in concert with our partners. And we relate that to the Oregon benchmark number 36, which is a benchmark that deals with general funding obligations and bond rating. So high performance and bond rating go hand in hand in our industry, and we want to make sure that we do everything in our part to make sure that the integrity of that is not lost because of our agency. Similar to the increase in community involvement and building capacity, benchmarks that are related to that are benchmark 30, which references volunteer and civic activities for the state of Oregon. Our partnership with the Oregon Volunteer Commission is the agency or the group that works with us on having that activity be accomplished, along with many of our other partners, both our CDCs and our CAP organizations, community development corporations, and community action partners who are responsible for organizing and instituting volunteerism support within their local communities. Goal objective 3 is increase self-sufficiencies among lower-income people. Again, a very major goal in Oregon, one that always seems to be one just a hand reach away from us as we try to accomplish the opportunities for affordability and self-sufficiency for Oregonians. But the goals relate to benchmarks on the percentage of Oregonians with incomes below 30% of the poverty level, and goal number 57, which percentage of Oregon households that are food insecure and food insecure without hunger, which many of you have known for the last 2 years of the USDA report, Oregon has ranked number one in that category of food insecurity. And there is a great tie between, and I shouldn't say not a great tie in the sense that it's a joyful tie, but there's an interesting relationship between food insecurity and the cost of housing. They go hand in hand. People ask me, how can that be? If they're low income and they have so much resource in their hand at the beginning of the month after they've gotten their paycheck, they have to pay the fixed items such as their rent, pay their utility bills, pay their car payments, pay their child care, pay their the list of things that are requirement payments before, so you don't have suffer consequences. Usually what's last in low-income families is the resources left for food, and that's where they have a tendency to somewhat thin the soup, in the sense that parents may skip a meal because they want to get their children to get fed, or the children may go to school with not the same kind of breakfast that every other child might be going to school, so there's issues around food programs at schools that we try to make sure that there's a relationship to. But again, food insecurity and homelessness are huge issues relative to the population that we serve with on an ongoing basis. And then finally,
Senator Carter.
Bob, just one question on the homelessness situation. Number one, percentage-wise, how much have we been able to put more homeless people in housing, number one, and number two, if you will, our church is working with people who don't have addresses so that they can receive appropriate mail that they're supposed to have in terms of their care. So how is the housing agency helping? And I know this is a local kind of a local issue, but I was just wondering if you could tell us a little bit about that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Carter, I think I'll try to, maybe Mr. Kenny will have the facts while I'm talking quickly, but
I don't mind waiting until that
person comes. Well, let me give you just a quick read. Last session, if you may recall, that the Assembly approved a $1.4 million increase to the homeless account. It had not had any new resources put to it since 1991, thank you. And so that was a major new injection of resources. If you think about housing homelessness for almost 12 years, where the amount of dollars that were received in 1991 versus the value of that dollar in the 2001 market, it had devalued considerably. So by the increase of $1.4 million, that did buy back some of the bed spaces and increase the stopping of closures. What we were seeing last session, we aren't seeing quite this session, there goes another photo, we had a lot of homeless facilities closing down because there was no resources. And with the extra money we received last biennium, we were able to reconstitute and reopen those facilities. However, as the economy has taken its downturn over the last year and so, we are also seeing a high increase of people who were not homeless under the economic conditions of 2 years ago who are homeless today. And so it is always vacillating back and forth, I think. And we're probably not getting ahead of it. We were gaining on a little bit, but probably not getting ahead of it today in today's economy. And then Mr. Kenny does have a report here on
the benchmark report. See, the funding did make a temporary increase, but we don't have the O2 numbers yet. You're right. I think it's projected to increase.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that in that part of the program, Senator Carter. Again, we do have some numbers that we'll be able to show you compared to how much it spiked when you did give us the money, and then it's been tailing down again. And then increase of home ownership is the last one. Again, this is a goal that obviously we were originally charged with in 1971 to give people the opportunity to reach the dream of home ownership. We do this on a regular basis, an ongoing basis for home ownership. We put in service approximately 100 and about six, somewhere between 1,200 and 1,400 single-family homes every year. We have put, I think, in the last 3 years, 4,600 or $4,500 units of single-family home in the marketplace. So it involves, as I'll talk to you a little later, about both not getting people just into housing, but also training them and learning the fundamentals of home ownership. because many of them have never had that opportunity. They're coming from prior generations who were not homeowners, so you have to start a new learning process for many of them. Quickly to the organizational chart that you'll find on pages 9 and 10. Page 9 is how we are organized through this biennium in a kind of a real quick comprehensive look without a lot of bunch of small print and names adjoining those positions. This position list shows at the beginning represents 148 positions as we were approved for last biennium. Again, you can see we are divided into programs that relate to the activities, both the business side, administrative and property side, our resource side, our information and communication side, and our community service side and energy and manufactured housing programs. So again, we've lined up all of our programs so that there's a good working relationship on an ongoing basis. For this biennium, as you were here and have the budget presented to you, on the next page, budget 10, organizational chart 10, you will see same boxes, everybody's in the same place. However, the positions have increased. The request you will be seeing will be an additional of staffing, so it brings the total positions to 156 positions, and we will go through those individual positions to tell you what they are proposed or anticipated to do during those portions of the presentation of the individuals who will be representing those sections of the budget. Going over to, again, following that, you will find a description of the organizational divisions of each of the assessments or each of the groups as they break out, so you can see how we've tried to group them together. And again, because we're on a somewhat of a close time here for everybody today, I want to flip you over to page 13 if I could, and that's the agency programs and service summaries. This again is a very high level picture of this agency. Again, as I've mentioned to you before, each supervisor or administrator will be talking specifically about each of these programs. But this gives you an idea of the level of our budget when you heard that we are small in the general fund application, but we are huge in other funds. This gives you a flavor of that size of huge that we are. As you can see, much of our business is in the home ownership program. That's our purchasing program for first-time buyers. That's much of those is our loans that are being held in the value of that $764 million. Also, it does refer to the last 3 years of completing and selling or financing almost 4,500 loans. And I want to stop frame here for you just to let you know we are currently in the marketplace for Oregonians at 4.95% interest, 30-year fixed mortgage. These are times that no one would ever have dreamed of. And we have in a very business-like manner, been very mindful of our sales, and we have been saving what we call zero coupons so we can blend to keep these rates down as much. We just had a sale last week as an example, and the sale of that was made available was at 5.36% interest. But we have what we call zero coupons that we have collected that we have to use eventually, or we have to give them back to the government. So we blend those with the sale that we just had as an example, and so we are still offering at 4.95% interest for 30-year fixed mortgages. And that's a huge opportunity for people who have never had an opportunity to buy a house. Matter of fact, you're starting to see it actually in the industry today. There's a high amount of vacancies in units, rental units, because many of those people are going to home ownership. So it's kind of an interesting anomaly where you're having a higher degree of vacancies, not because people can't afford that, but they are actually in a position where they're able to get into home ownership where they may not have been at 6 and 7% interest loans. Next grouping is the affordable rental housing development program. Again, this is our next largest activity. This is where we use our low-income families for rental housing, our multifamily programs using a variety of cash streams, included as the Oregon Lenders Tax Credits, the Oregon Housing Trust Account, a series of federal programs, low-income tax credit programs, HELP, and HOME, which effectively, when grouped together, make affordable housing available for low-income families in multifamily environments. The third program, as you kind of group us together, our food programs. We are basically a pass-through program for the food banks of Oregon and or our partnership with those food banks. We work in a coordinated effort with them. I, by statute, am charged with chairing an interagency coordinating council on hunger that deals with all aspects of hunger for the state of Oregon, where we have all agencies represented there at that council forum meeting. We have a task force of individuals that work outside of the council who make recommendations to us, and then we work in a cohesive way to try to either advance those to the governor or implement those on an agency-by-agency basis. A good example would be 2 years ago we took on the issues of the food stamp application, and I don't know how many of you ever realized or ever did that, but a food stamp application was near 24 pages long. Now, for somebody who is looking for a little assistance in trying to fill out one that's 24 pages long, it would challenge you whether or not you really wanted to put yourself through that. The council, along with the task force, worked with Department of Human Services and other groups that had an interest in seeing what we could do to improve that, and we were able to complete a new form that was 2 pages long with printing on both sides, so 4 pages in total. So it shows you you can, when you get enough people together saying, why do we always ask these same questions? They say, well, I guess we don't really have to, and we were able to glean that down to a substantially less number of pages, which saves time for the applicant, saves time for the person who's processing the paper at the same time. So successes are notable there, and it's an ongoing activity, particularly in light of the governor's strong position on hunger for the state of Oregon. Again, homeless programs are our next. We are an administrator of these programs, more so than an operator of these programs. These are resources, generally general fund dollars that come to us, that deal with the four bulleted items below: emergency shelter, transitional housing, permanent housing, and prevention activities, which are primarily ran by your local partners, your CAP organizations, more specifically, who run these programs on behalf of your communities. Again, this is primarily general fund dollars that do pass through our hands and to our local partners. I'd like to tell you also at that same time, other general fund dollars that this agency has collected on a biannual basis. As an example of last year's total general fund dollars, we only use less than $300,000 of that for administrative costs for the agency. So we have taken a commitment or made a commitment on behalf of our community partners that we will not take general fund administrative dollars, or where we can, off of general fund dollars to run our programs. We have chosen to let that money pass through to our partners so they can use it to provide services for Oregonians. How we do that, you ask, is because we are good business people on the other side, and we are entrepreneurs in the sense that we are bankers to the extent where we have the opportunity to create other resources and proceeds from our banking activities. And so through those banking activities is how we pay for much of our staffing and do not have to tap into the general fund resources for administrative costs. And then finally on page 14, we have a series of other smaller programs but also very significant. We have the weatherization programs, which has increased dramatically since two sessions ago when Senate Bill 1149 was passed, which was the Power D Reg bill. There has been substantial increases from the federal government on weatherization assistance to all states, of which we have been given our share of that resource. So we work as the clearinghouse with our partners in making sure that weatherization dollars are sent out for both energy upgrades to homes, paying power bills, and assisting on disconnects. And so it's a variety of ways we attack issues on energy, but they all, at the end of the day, make for a better living environment in all cases, and will keep people in place so they're not being disposed or displaced because they couldn't pay their power bill or their power is being turned off. Rental assistance program, again, it's a small program relative to some of the other programs, but it does a lot for the agency. It develops self-sufficiency and helps individuals to get the necessary support, counseling, and training to provide them. And there goes another picture. My timing is basic. Yeah. If I can get all the pictures down, I'm done.
I know. It's just for sure. Can you just count down before I talk?
it has to do. It's similar to our revenue forecast.
It's going down.
Well, I was going to ask if we promise to stay awake with these pictures we follow.
We've been doing this, so you'll stay awake. And then the final two, community services and expansion. We have again, we are very blessed. We have a great relationship with community partners, both nonprofits and quasi-federal or state agency programs that are housing authorities, which are quasi-government. We have a great relationship with CAP organizations, which are quasi-government because they have a relationship with the local county. Because we have that, we have service relationships that we have an ongoing basis with to make sure they're both that they are both viable and are able to exist to be doing the services of what we cannot do in the building. And our advocacy and operational support, again, is just really the last of all the last of things. This is really us as a department as a whole, where we do our day-to-day work on behalf of our ACT programs, and it's, you know, behind the scenes day-to-day work of a lending institute and a community service program. So, Mr. Chairman, that is just a quick overview of what my part of the program was. And again, I apologize. I will be leaving here probably in a half an hour to head down to Grants Pass. But Mr. Kenny and my other staff are more than able to take care of this presentation, and I know that they will do a wonderful job for me.
And you have a safe trip down there, and hopefully nothing else blows up or falls down.
Let's hope not. It wasn't, you know, Mr. Chairman, it's kind of interesting. This is one of those readiness issues that you never anticipate, and it has caused a very chilling effect on my agency because this could be anywhere. And because of this now, we will develop an emergency plan that will be able to be in place so that if something like this is ever, God forbid, ever happened again, we would be able to react in a very smooth transition to help people in the system so they aren't suffering in multiple fronts.
You used the word blew up. Was this a gas leak or something that ignited this? Or?
Mr. Chairman, they don't know it's done in an arson inspection. It was an explosion. Apparently there was a fire that was started somehow in the lower levels of this four-story building. Or three-story building, and there were some compressors that were in there for their nailing equipment that they would nail, you know, framers and carpenters would use for nailing air guns, and the tank got overheated and became a missile. Let's leave those down. So it wasn't, and it literally caused the building just to have an explosion. It knocked windows out two blocks away from the place.
Mm-hmm. I'll speak a little more. Okay. I'm sorry. If you recall, in our committee last session, when we were upstairs, mm-hmm. that we passed some emergency response legislation,
right.
And I'm just wondering if Director Repine could let us know how effectively did we use the services of the state and local communities on in terms of emergency response to your agency?
The emergency response legislation is discussed in the interim.
I'm sorry, I'm drawing a blank on that.
Yeah, well, we need to know that
yeah.
because
mm-hmm. right.
suppose this were not just an ordinary incident, that's it, could have been a terrorist act.
Mm-hmm.
How quickly could the emergency response team have responded to that or have worked with you to respond to that? Because it would appear to me, Mr. Chairman, if we find agencies need to have something that is within their agencies to deal with emergency response, but if the resources of the state and local governments is going to be like we have been working with that, somewhere along the line, they should have been advising them on this issue. And we need to know how the system works along those lines, because somewhere along the line, it seemed to me as if that situation was a real opportunity for the emergency response team to have been put into action like that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Carter, now that I have kind of a feel for it, and I've ran it through my head a little bit. I think the emergency response development we did as an agency, like all the state agencies did, was, you know, kind of like on, you know, what happens to us to a great degree. What happens if our building is destroyed or incapacitated or something? So we have a, you know, a strategy or emergency plan relative to that. I think the interesting part about this is, and I'm not saying that anybody did blatantly, but I think what we learned from it is that we never really have prepared a community.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Red Cross was there. They've entered into
right.
it. But interestingly enough, from my staff's report, I've assigned somebody on it full-time down there so they can stay on top of this to help hold this together, is the Red Cross's goal was to get the people out of the building into somewhere else.
But they didn't realize that this was a fragile population that just couldn't live somewhere else. They eventually had to be brought back to something that represents more of an institutional environment for them. And so the Red Cross did their job. They got them out, got them taken care of, got them placed with their family members. But in their estimation, that's kind of where they're done, and I don't disagree with them. They are done there. The question now is how does the community and we as the lenders get with all the other lenders who are in multiple layers of financing on these developments and go through this myriad of paperwork that we're going to have to go through, both federal law and state law, to peel back all the bureaucratic bumbling that will go about to get these projects back in full swing again. So you're right. This is a terrible example, but an opportunity for us to learn and set a program in place where we'll have something that we can say, if you have something like this, make sure you have the Red Cross, make sure you have the Housing Authority, make sure you have the CAP agency, make sure you have whatever it is, and pull them together so you have a checklist. You know, naivety was the issue here. We never thought we'd ever have this.
My point is, they should have to wonder about that. If there is the statewide emergency response team that we are paying for, why weren't they there to advise you as an agency of that? That's what I'm saying. And, Mr. Chairman, they need to come before this committee to talk about the effectiveness of such an operation in this state when something like this happened. Because I thought, and maybe I'm wrong, I thought that it was supposed to be for this purpose when something is of an explosionary nature or this kind of emergency, mm-hmm. that's what the emergency response team is supposed to do. And if it's not, I stand corrected, but it would appear to me that they should have been practicing.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Carter, I will be going down there to Mass Pass, and I can report back to you what presence I feel there or a sense of that control that may or may not be in place at the time.
With another question from Representative Hanson.
Thank you. One of my concerns is that as we look at your budget, especially if we look at it within the perspective of everything else that's going on budget-wise, it'd be very helpful. You've got some incredibly talented people. If, as we look through this, I'd like to know what's the impact when we start making significant changes with the Oregon Health Plan. I mean, if that comes out only covering pregnant women and children, what's the shakeout going to do to affordable housing as you start shifting healthcare for vulnerable populations having another huge chunk? Certainly with Oregon leading the nation in hunger, any recommendations that we could have in terms of, I think everybody in this building is trying to grapple with the hunger problem and I mean, certainly use any good ideas on that. And then in the energy weatherization programs, we on Ways and Means heard an economist from PGE on Friday talking about the reality that energy costs are going to double probably for the next year or 2 years. And what's that going to have on an impact both on our state program as well as on housing? Because, again, you've got another cost factor in vulnerable population budgets. And the real challenge for us this year is how do we fit these various budgets together as a puzzle. And we know that the puzzle is probably going to be smaller than the one that we had 2 years ago. Well, we know it's going to be smaller, but still, how do we make all the pieces fit? And so that we don't end up with unintended consequences of decisions that we make with health care or economy problems catching us off guard, like the rising energy costs, that end up crippling one of your programs. And I guess somewhere through this, and you don't need to respond now because that's probably a two-hour problem. But in order to get your budget into the proper perspective, if your team has had thoughts in these areas, I think it'd be real helpful to us.
Chairman, the representative, without having to respond to your question, I'm sure during the course of the next today and tomorrow you'll hear some very good examples of things that can be offered as suggestions to contemplate, or things that we're trying to implement right now to try to get our head to hedge the bet, so to speak, on those rising costs. But yeah, it's no matter what you do in this budget environment, you are as either outside pressures put things on you, such as utilities, or you have internal things such as budget rebalancing and other programs that might bleed into our same population. Sometimes the consequences are measurable, are known going into it. Assisted living facilities would come to mind, because we can do the calculation if rents are reduced on Medicaid reimbursement. That's what we know about the units. We don't necessarily know about the individual's person that's in those units as to their level of care or subsidy they're getting vis-a-vis either health care programs and or Oregon Health Plan dollars. That's an unknown to us. And so it, sometimes that would only play out as it becomes more of a reality as to, you know, to what degree it has put a hardship on that person. So, but my suspicion would be any reductions like that can have and would have an effect on some of our population. Not all of it, but some of our population.
Mr. Chair, just as we go through all of these different presentations, we talk a lot about, and there are a lot of people in the system. They are getting food stamps, they're getting housing assistance, they're getting all of this. There are a lot, and I think a growing number at the moment, of people who aren't in that system, who are low income. And I know I get phone calls periodically from somebody who isn't in the system, who hit a snag in life, and is there any help out there available? So just as you go through the different programs, if you could talk about what kind of outreach there is. I think we tend to get fixated on the people that have identified themselves to us, who've waded through the 24-page application or whatever, and that we can identify, or maybe they're, you know, third generation on the services or whatever the heck the reason is. We found them. But some of them don't really want to be found. They're going to figure out how to survive on that lower income level. Family, friends, neighbors help them until something happens. And then it seems to me that they don't know how to get the help they need.
Mr. Chairman,
but as you're going through,
Senator, I think my staff, again, will bring that up on the service side. We have some service programs that are there designed to come in and just shore a family up for a month or 2 months or 3 months, so that once they get back on their feet that they don't have to be part of the long-term system people. Different populations, we have to handle each one, you know, both the larger service population and those people who fall in and out of financial situations in their lives.
And I know you have them, and so when somebody calls, I'm afraid that there are a lot of people who may qualify who don't ever find them.
Absolutely. Mr. Kenny, it's all yours.
Director?
All the pictures are off the wall, so
yeah.
I'm good to go.
Next time. First.
Mr. Kenny, we welcome you here. Is anyone going to come up with you, or are you going to present by yourself? Deputy Director.
Director Repine just said I'm on my own. Senator George.
You're on your own.
Pictures are off the wall, so,
Members of the committee.
That'll teach you for being a deputy.
Yeah.
I have a little easel in my office. Would you like me to have it brought up here? No, seriously. So they could.
You know, I might take you up, but okay. not at this time.
We can set him up on the chair.
Sure.
Again, for the record, my name is Jack Kenny. I'm the Deputy Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services. And Senator Dukes and Representative Hansen's questions anticipated some of my remarks, so I'll try to get to that. I'm going to talk a little bit about the agency's the performance, its strategic plan, our long-term goals and objectives in relationship to Oregon benchmarks, and the policy and funding implications for the department and for you as the legislature. Just quickly to get to Senator Duke's questions and comments, there are some new initiatives to get the word out, and as Bob indicated, the people from the community action agencies will be testifying on tomorrow, time permitting. Some of the new ideas that are being kicked around is like a 211 phone number similar to 911, so that if someone has a need and they're not in the system, so to speak, and they're not familiar with the system, they'll get a number to call. There have also programs, I think it used to be called Oregon Help, so the eligibility estimator. There they're changing the name periodically, but again, it's still in the pilot stage, is my understanding, where someone could get online. Now, I know everyone doesn't have a computer, and I think they are also talking about using them at the employment department kiosks, where someone could get in and just say, do I qualify? What's out there? And plug in rough income figures. So there are some outreach efforts in place, but I'll let the service people talk more about that. Regarding the pieces to the puzzle and how they all fit together, Representative Hant.
Before we get away from this, I'm troubled by the fact that we have our number one in hunger. And I looked on page 13 in the food programs, 3.2 million. And we have 20 regional coordinated agencies and 750 direct service agencies. Somehow that just does not look like enough money with the number of agencies. Is it possible for you guys to provide for us, or maybe you're going to do that, a reasonable handle or description of how this whole system works relative to food programs? Because, I mean, I think this is a problem that's going to get much worse, and this just doesn't look, when you look at $335 million for affordable rental housing, I know that's a different program, but home ownership of $764, and then you look at $3 million for food programs, it just kind of grabs you from the standpoint of inadequacy. So if we could have some help on getting an understanding. Now, these folks may understand it. I don't, so appreciate any help.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mr.
I think that's a good question, because if we have 45% of the people in a state low income and paying 30% of their income to rent, somebody asked one of the questions before, they want to see the effectiveness and see the profile of people who are saying that they're hungry. Well, I'm not interested in as far as my role in the legislature is, and whether people are cheating to get food. I think in the richest country in the world, that when people are hungry, 30% of your income going to your rent is telling you that some people are hungry in the state. And Oregon needs not to just worry about being ashamed, because we're number one in the nation. What we need to do is try to do something about it. And so I think, associated with the issues that they're looking at, how are we getting these numbers down would make a big difference. And Mr. Chairman, if I can just put the cynical in there for a few minutes. I want to tell you how pleased, and that you should be pleased to know that from among our ranks some years ago when Bob Repine was appointed state director, that his leadership is just amazing across this state. And I want him to know how pleased I am. I want you to know what a good representative he is to this state as state housing director. He has done a good job, and I see the efficiency and the effectiveness of his agency and the people that work for him. So I just really want to give him kudos on record.
Well, here we were going to try to hold him at his present wage increase, and then look what you did.
That's what the kudos are for.
Yeah.
No money.
Senator George, if I may just add on Senator Carter's comments, and this is certainly in no way, I'm sure the food bank people would agree with you that the funding is inadequate in the light of the problem, but I know Director Repine himself has been involved as the leader of the Interagency Coordinating Council on Hunger in looking at efforts for gleaning when the farm community is just plowing food back into the ground. As a legislator, he was a big proponent of prison labor, and he's using the correctional facilities staff. We've been in discussions with corrections. As, you know, can we warehouse food in the eastern part of the state that is salvageable? Perhaps not, you know, the A-grade potatoes, for example, that McDonald's wants to buy, but certainly something that could help the state. So, in addition to the dollar number, there are initiatives underway to take advantage of opportunities such as that. And again, to get to Representative Hansen's comments before I get into my prepared remarks, we are also struggling with getting a handle on, you know, where the pieces of the puzzle are. Senator Carter talked about people paying 30% of their median income and the high percentage in Oregon that does that. The Harvard study that's referenced in our materials, if you do the numbers, would indicate that there's 10% of the population nationwide that's paying 50% of their income for rent. And it's probably higher in Oregon, although we don't have those numbers specifically. So clearly that's a factor in food insecurity. And if you add energy and additional medical costs, that's kind of the environment we're in right now. So let me just I did want to talk about our long-term goals, our strategic plan, and in relationship to the Oregon benchmark and the funding implications for you all. I would state plainly that Oregon has a long way to go to meet the objectives that are set forth in the benchmarks for homelessness, housing, and hunger. These benchmarks are impacted by factors that are outside our control, of course, the economy, for example, wage rates in Oregon and things like that. But we as an agency are not going to use that as an excuse to let us off the hook, that there's nothing we can do about the problem. We know we need to be accountable to you and to the taxpayers. And I'm going to talk more about our efforts to be accountable later, and I'm sure Rick Crager and others will hit on what we do to hold ourselves accountable to you and to the taxpayers later in our presentation on the budget. I do want to talk, and it's already been discussed a little bit, but about the environment in which we operate and a quick and give you a quick background on program trends. As Bob has already indicated, our programs range from home ownership, so that large number you see, those are loans, of course, and so that's the individuals who are borrowing that money, but it does flow through our budget. So you have programs at one end of the spectrum with home ownership, and we have our community development block grant program that helps low-income homeowners to stay in their homes, for example, roof repairs, septic system replacements, things like that, energy assistance for low-income people who are in their homes. But it goes down the spectrum from workforce housing for our rental housing and rent payment assistance as it goes down the spectrum to homelessness and food programs. Regarding our environment, every year the National Home Builders Association publishes its Housing Opportunity Index. That's the way that they can compare housing prices with wages in the economy. So you get kind of an apples-to-apples comparison with obviously housing prices, for example, are higher in New York, but people in New York typically make more than they do in Oregon. But in the last Housing Opportunity Index that the home builders did, and this is for home ownership, the four Oregon communities that are large enough to be listed in the 191 metropolitan areas listed, all four of them were in the bottom 20%, and three of them were in the bottom 15%. So housing prices are extremely high relative to wages in Oregon. So that's the one. As far as rental housing, it's a very similar situation. Senator Carter's already made comments on some of the information that was in our materials. And just to reiterate, 45% of renter households in Oregon pay more than 30% of their income for rent. Someone on minimum wage in Oregon would have to work 79 hours a week to afford a two-bedroom unit, the area's fair market rent. And when you put in things like child care and things like that, I mean, even if you had two wage earners working full-time, if there's child care and things like that.
Say that again.
This is a statistic from the National Low-Income Housing Coalition, and they said that someone earning minimum wage in Oregon must work 79 hours a week to afford a two-bedroom unit at the area fair market rent.
Everything else they can pay for in that last hour?
Well, that's at the fair market, and that's why so many people are paying more than what the federal government considers the appropriate level of income, and that's why it's likely why you'll see things like food insecurity being so high in the state.
But Mr. Chairman.
Senator Carter.
I have a niece and a nephew. She works at Nike.
Mm-hmm.
He works for UPS and another company. Right. The rent in Northeast Portland, in my district, mm-hmm. is so high that both of those young people have two jobs with three kids.
Mm-hmm.
The rent is just that high. So they are part of that 10% that the rent is that high.
Was that an Oregon statistic?
Chair George, Senator Dukes, yes.
Even given the increase in the minimum wage, of course, they understand that pushed other things up as well.
I believe the study was from last year, so that might have been prior to the minimum wage increase.
Yeah, but with other costs, could you glean out some of those numbers for us and provide us kind of a little? You don't want to see those.
Yes, I do. Yes,
I'd be happy to do that.
Oh, great, Senator Morris.
No, I wish it's still reflecting.
Mr. Chairman, I know that your position on DLCD has not, or the land use issues.
I was going through my mind as you
has not been a popular position in some quarters, but I would suggest this discussion would cause some thoughtful reflection on the policies in this state that have caused us to achieve these kinds of rankings, and that maybe there are some policy corrections that are due for consideration.
Just a note. I've been haunted by it. Something we were told, I believe, last session, and that is that average family is more. It's actually more affordable. It may be a change now because of the condition of the Hawaiian economy. It was more affordable to have a home and a job, being able to afford a home in Honolulu, than it was to have one in Oregon, and that's just an unbelievable number.
That's right.
You know, and that's it. And I'm sure that we're probably now much worse off than we were at that time, which we thought we were in pretty good shape.
Okay.
I do they live here.
All right.
HUD.
The
federal HUD and rural development, they do a great job of providing rental assistance, but waiting lines for Section 8 vouchers are typically 1 year or more. HUD and Section 8 and the RD program is similar. Basically what that does is pays whatever the family earns, they pay 30% of their of what they earn to the rent, and HUD makes up the difference, or RD makes up the difference. There are exceptions that I'm oversimplifying, but that's essentially how that program works. So that's the biggest game in town. Oh, pardon me.
Yes, sir.
I seem to recall 2 years ago that we had a lot of Section 8 housing that was, I mean, it's on a contract's probably not the right term, but they sign up for X number of years, that we had a large percentage of our Section 8 housing that, whose timeline was about to come to an end, and people can re-up, but they don't have to. Where are we in that?
Senator George, Senator Dukes, I was going to get to that.
Oh, go ahead.
If I could.
Take your time.
Okay.
We'll be quiet and let you...
No. I appreciate the question, but I... That's probably in here. Okay. Thank you, though. There's approximately... HUD estimates that there's 129,000 eligible families in Oregon that do not receive rental assistance that are eligible. In effect, the federal government helps with 29% of eligible families in Oregon. And it's already been discussed here at length. Oregon is earning unwanted notoriety as number one in the nation in food insecurity and hunger. And Representative Hansen's already going to talk about rising energy costs and the need for energy bill payment assistance. And specifically, and I think Bob Gillespie on our staff might talk about this, but this does have real, tangible effects to our program, because there's some of the federal programs put a cap on the rent that they can charge. But that rent includes utilities. So, in effect, the low-income household is somewhat protected because of that federal cap. But on the other hand, now we have our partners who have got the mortgage on the property who can't charge enough rent to make debt service, which could affect the department. So when I get to where we're talking about, it does have kind of a ripple effect, and Bob, unless you can talk about that a little bit more, but just to let you know, that is something... You know, during the energy crisis a couple of years ago, that we've given a great deal of thought to, and it is going to have ramifications for our programs. So we have enormous challenges to face together, and House Bill 5029, our budget, represents a partial response to these challenges. We all recognize that there's not enough money to adequately address these challenges. So how do you decide the right amount of money to allocate to our programs, and how do we decide where to allocate those limited resources? Regarding how much we need, obviously we support the funding that's included in the governor's recommended budget. In a future session, under better economic circumstances, we will likely make a case for increases and tell you clearly what we will achieve if we get the additional money. As to how to allocate the money that we do receive, we have probably three primary criteria, which are probably embodied in those long-term objectives. One that Bob, I think, is really... Bob Repine has brought to the department is value added relative to other choices. Where's the value added? And I'll give you a couple examples. I was going to talk about this a little bit in more detail, but in the interest of time, I'll just touch on it. A couple areas that we looked at in our strategic plan were preservation, which is the loss of the affordable housing. And I'm going to talk about that at a little bit more length later, because it's such a huge issue for the department. But some of the other issues where value added comes into play is transitional housing for ex-offenders, or for people who might, people coming out of jail or people coming out of institutions. We can pay a little bit more for the housing to get a service component linked into it. And I got in using the prison ex-offender housing as an example, to incarcerate a person, I believe, and I, you know, could, my numbers are roughly accurate, $66 a day, I think, is the number that I hear thrown around to keep someone in an institution. If we have someone who's outside of the institution, our housing costs with services maybe run around $11, $12 a day. So it's a lot. And if you take the reduction in recidivism, and that's kind of the numbers that we're getting to. We're trying to get a handle. That's one thing I'm going to talk on a little bit later. Bill Carpenter, our IS, our information systems person, will talk about. We're trying to get a handle on so that we can tell you, you give us this amount of money, this is the expected benefit. That's our goal. We're not 100% there yet. I don't know if we're 50% there yet, but that's really where we'd like to be as an agency, is tell you, you give us this money, we'll get these kind of results. But in the case of transitional housing for ex-offenders, if we can put services there where there's probation officers, where there's alcohol and drug counselors, where there's job counselors on site, it's going to cost a little more than your standard housing of giving them a motel voucher or just put them in a facility that, you know, maybe they're back with their old cronies. But if you can reduce the recidivism by an X percent, you can just calculate how much you've saved the state. And that doesn't, you know, that doesn't include property savings, you know, when they do reoffend, if you reduce, you know, recidivism. So those are the kinds of factors. When we get money, we look at how it allocated. It's similar with people coming out of institutions who might be just a drain, if you will, on the government, on the economy, on the taxpayers. But we had one in Roseburg that I looked at, so it's anecdotal, but the service, again, we paid a little bit more, but we had a service provider on site, and she was able to tell so-and-so's not on their meds today. Boom. I need to take them aside. I need to get them on their meds. Or so-and-so's supposed to be in a job training class. They're not showing up. I need to, you know, sit on them for a minute and make sure that they go there. Those people, they had a great track record of people going out and actually earning money, paying taxes, as opposed to just being a total drain. So value added is a key component that we look at. And preservation, I'm going to speak on in a little more detail later, is another great aspect, because as Senator Dukes indicated, there's huge amounts of federal subsidies that could be lost to the state if we don't spend a little now. Another factor that we look at is economic stimulus. What can we do with, and Bob and Jeannie, others talk about that. Economic stimulus takes a couple factors. One is, for example, downtown development. We got some funds in the last session for what's called the Community Incentive Fund. And Bob Repine gave me this little chart on the cost of an empty storefront, $250,000 in lost sales, $15,000 in lost rent, $51,000 in lost loan demand to local banks. It goes on and on. We've had some great successes, and again, I think Bob Gillespie might talk about those, with where we put money into, there was one downtown property in Pendleton that had been a burnout store sitting vacant for years. Put retail on the ground floor with housing above. Served a great community need, and I think you're seeing even the smaller communities are finding that there is some demand for housing above the storefront levels. Not, you know, it's not probably like downtown Portland, but there is some, and that's a niche that we can fill. And again, getting those storefronts and getting the downtowns revitalized, if we can demonstrate economic vitality, value added, then we're going to do that too. Other economic stimulus operations that we take part in, workforce housing. I'm going to talk a little bit later about some big increases in federal tax credits, but because there's not a corresponding increase in grant funding, we're able to use some of those tax credits to meet community needs to get housing for not the very poor people, but people who are at a working wage who still need rents that are reasonable and close to their work. So, and then finally, partner capacity, and that can take a couple different aspects, but we don't. We talked about this before the meeting. We don't really deliver services ourselves, with very few exceptions. We work through community partners, housing authorities, community development corporations, community action agencies, and they're all going to have a chance for public testimony hopefully tomorrow, and others, cities, counties, for-profit developers. There's a variety of partners that we work with. If you totally turn off the spigot on funding, these community action agencies, these community development corporations, they've developed over time, but they need a certain book of business and to keep going. And they provide, again, they're able. That's why Bob was saying we don't take any of the general fund ourselves. We pass it on to the partners. That's because these community development corporations and housing authorities and those other people are delivering the services is a good reason. And they're more closely in touch with what the community needs are. So that's a factor that we use in allocating scarce resources. We use these criteria in developing our strategic plan. And I have to applaud this committee, but Senator Dukes was on it last year, but talk to us about our strategic plan as an agency. And we took that message to heart. After the committee meetings, we looked at our strategic plan. Oh, Representative Smith was on it as well, I think. And we came up with a strategic plan that had tangible, measurable objectives. And I think we've, Bob and I visited with you and Rick and given you kind of our PR piece on that. But it talked about five external goals, had to do with transitional housing for ex-offenders, farm worker housing. We were given a lot of responsibility in the last session to up the state's role in providing farm worker housing. Preservation, the issue that Senator Dukes talked about. Homelessness, again, huge issue in the state and what we do about that. And then the last one was community development, and we'll talk about regional housing centers and the community center fund that I mentioned. Our internal goals have to do with developing the data, and Bill Carpenter is going to talk about that later, but our OPIS computer system. We realize as our partners, one of the gripes that we heard, and it was, you know, to get money from your department, we have to fill out all this paperwork. There's all these forms, and then we have to repeat it over and over again. It's just a hassle. Bill and his people have put together an online reporting system so that if we need the report five different ways for the feds, the data will all be there. We can press a button and get it different ways. Had tremendous. It's one of those high-profile state computer programs that, fortunately, you haven't read about. So far, it's been a great success and has really linked the remote areas of the state with our headquarters in Salem. And I actually went on the road and talked to the people. It's getting rave reviews. It's kind of in the early stages, but it gets back to that self-sufficiency benchmark and that value added. We'd like to be able to say, if we put our money in these programs, you know, we gave this homeless family assistance. 2 years from now, they're back on their feet. They're self-sufficient. We don't have that kind of information at this point in time. And you deserve it. We need to get it for you to tell you this program is effective. This is where we're spending our money, and this program's getting results. We understand there's always going to be a certain chronic homeless population, for example, or people who will always need government assistance. But for that other population where we really do expect people to take the government resources and move on so that the next group can get them when their time comes, we need databases to do that. When we dealt with our strategic plan, all these problems that I talked about early in my discussion with the economy, it was easy to say, hey, I know we have a problem there. I don't need data to tell me we have a problem there. But we do need data ultimately to say what's the highest need, what are our highest priorities for programs. So that is an internal initiative that you didn't see in that document that we turned out. And Rick and Craig, our chief financial officer, and Bill have done a great job in getting the infrastructure in place for that, as well as our policies and procedures. Again, I'd like to just spend the last few minutes of my time to talk about some key issues, including preservation. Oregon's population grew 27% from 1990 to 2000. Housing costs have increased significantly. I talked to our data guru at the office before I came over this morning. Oregon repeat purchase housing price index from 90 to 2000, the price of a home in Oregon, according to that index, increased 98% in those 10 years, while wages, personal income increased 56%. So to Senator George's point earlier about Hawaii, yes, I think things have gotten worse lately. At least in the last 10 years. But real quickly, two factors associated with the federal affordable housing policy are impacting our budget and service delivery in different ways, so I want to talk about those. We've talked about this, so I'll just kind of briefly go through it. Federal standard for what families should pay is 30%. With rents and income levels being what they are, rent subsidies are sometimes the only way to achieve affordability for the very low-income populations. The federal government, through HUD and rural development, sent almost $500 million in rent subsidies to Oregon biannually. So every 2 years, Oregon gets $500 million biannually in rent subsidies. And again, that's hitting like the 29%. A good portion of those rent subsidies are provided through something called project-based assistance, and that's to Senator Duke's point again, as opposed to tenant-based assistance. And those projects were mostly developed in the 70s and probably late 60s, early 70s, many times with private sector developers. And those were typically 25, 30-year contracts. So a lot of those project-based contracts are up or coming due, so to speak. And if the private sector landlord wants to get out of the contract and convert it to market, that's okay. I mean, that's fair. That was part of the deal. we have, you know, we don't have any problem with that. Obviously, that's their rights. But in many cases, the private sector landlord is just wants to get their money out. You know, they're getting close to retirement age or what have you. They just want to get their money out, and they're not necessarily looking to flip it to market. Now, we know there are some downtown Portland locations, for example, that are prime locations. Those will go to market, but there's a lot of them that, again, the owner isn't really interested in flipping it to market, just really wants to get their money out. If we, the department, can line up a not-for-profit group to buy those facilities, the federal government typically keeps the rent subsidies in the project. And that was one of our key strategic plan goals for this biennium, was to preserve 3 to 5 of those units, because we need to keep those rent subsidies flowing to Oregon. That's a federal resource that can't be duplicated. We had done, I think, 4 maybe in our best year before that. It's a difficult sell because a lot of times, particularly in rural area, Portland, the city of Portland does a great job in Portland of identifying the preservation needs there. But for rural Oregon, you don't necessarily have a lot of organizations that have the financial wherewithal, for one thing, or have the time, if you will, to keep track of this issue. So we have been proactive. We've had our field people out training people. We've identified the projects and our office has been in contact with the owners, and I believe the numbers were, the biennium's not over, but with what we have in the works, we believe that we'll be able to preserve 11 projects with almost 365 units or more rent-subsidized units in Oregon in this biennium. So that's been a major success. Shelley Cullen for our department and our regional field reps have just done an outstanding job with that. So, but that's one place where we put our general fund, some of our general fund dollars, is a lot of, particularly in the rural areas, when we're finding a local housing authority that's not flush with cash or a nonprofit agency, they need a little bit of that general fund money just to get the ball rolling, to do the plans, to get their loan papers and get the appraisals, those kinds of things, do the assessment of what's going to be needed for rehab before they're going to jump into that. So that's been a big focus of our efforts, and I think it's been very successful. Oregon has lost over 1,100 rent-subsidized units, and I think there's 13,000 at risk currently. The second big change in the federal policy is when they stopped doing new Section 8 housing in the 80s, about 86 or 87, they replaced it with a program that's called the Low-Income Housing Tax Credit. It's a program whereby people who don't, again, organizations that don't have a lot of money can apply for, and we do a competitive process, they apply for tax credits. If they win, they can sell this tax credit to banks and other corporations that have a tax liability. They syndicate the tax credits, and that's how they're able to get cash to build affordable housing. That program, I think there was a consideration that maybe they were going to sunset it when the feds first put it in place in 86, 87. Turns out that they did not, and instead, like 2-3 years ago, and that's where this has a budget implication for us, they increased the tax credit program by 40%. It's a huge, huge increase in a federal program. The federal housing tax credit program is, let me tell you, it's very complicated. There are rules on who can be in it, what costs are eligible. When you look at it, I mean, those complications, they add costs. Now, those aren't general fund costs. The developers, the people who pay for the tax credits, they bear those costs. There's fees associated with the program. So it's a self-supporting program. But with a 40% increase in that program, Miles Slaver is going to talk a little bit later, but we're seeing big increases in the number of projects that we need to monitor. And that's one of the reasons that in these tough economic times, we feel that we still need to ask for some increased positions. So she's going to talk about that in a little bit more detail later. But it is a complex program. You have to make sure that the right people are in it. You have to make sure that only the correct costs are being paid for. And that's, we owe that to our partners. I mean, these banks, financial institutions, they're on the line. If they sign up and it turns out that the program isn't being used the way it should be, they can forfeit that tax credit that they've already paid for. And that would make the value of our program go down in a hurry if we ever had that happen. So it's worthwhile. Another thing with our project monitors that are going out that Marlos is going to talk about in a little, is it adds affordable housing in Oregon, I don't think, has a black eye. And I think, I remember when I first came before a Ways and Means Subcommittee in, I think it was probably 3-4 sessions ago, and Senator Hannon was on the subcommittee, and he asked about a project, an affordable housing project. It wasn't one of ours. And not to, and I don't say that to say we're good, they're bad, but at the time HUD was really in the process of getting hit hard for funding, and they didn't have enough people to do the monitoring. That's another thing that's going to be in our budget, is they've offloaded a lot of the HUD responsibilities to the state. They pay for it, again, not general fund, and they pay, you know, they pay a fair price for it. So you'll see that in some of our limitation positions. But again, Bob's not here, but another place I'll sing his praises. There were a few of our projects in our portfolio that were starting to be, I don't want to say, they weren't meeting community standards anyway. I won't say they were slums, but they are definitely starting to degrade the community. And we have cleared, first of all, we send our people out every year to look at the projects, look at the properties. And if they're not up to snuff, we get that back, and we start, you know, we start setting the rules in place. Okay, clean it up. Here's what we expect. We go out the next year or sooner if necessary and see if it's happened. So we set up a progression of what we need to do to keep community standards maintained using our project monitoring people. We've had to threaten people, actually take them to court when they didn't do that. And it's not fun, and it's not something that we do lightly, but it does, again, keep our programs in for the most part so that people are willing to take them in. And I know Jerry Croft from the Housing Authority is going to talk later, I mean not today, but in public testimony if he has time, about a South Fair project where putting the government money in, and I'm so happy to tell people this in this day, the government actually helps. And you put the government money in, you put the service monitoring there, and you take a project that was dilapidated, and you build it up. And property values around that property start increasing. And the community takes note of that. We had another project in Tigard where before the government, again, and you have to put service monitoring in, you have to spend a little more money for that, but the police calls went down to almost nothing, whereas before it had been a high crime area. So that's what you buy with your property management. And again, it's not general funded.
Senator Carter.
I'm so glad to hear government working person say the government does help. That gives me reason to have a little more faith in government, since I hear so much negative stuff about government and people not being engaged in it, so I'm proud to hear you say that. But my question is, and I think I served on the Revenue Committee in 1995, and we passed some tax incentives for developers, especially regarding Woodburn, and I'd just like to know the effectiveness of that and of those tax incentives at that time.
Senator George, Senator Carter, I'm assuming that you're referring to the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit, perhaps. There's probably two tax credits, the Farm Worker Housing Tax Credit and the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit, which used to be called the Lenders Tax Credit in Oregon. It's been a very effective program. I should get my testimony from, because we're trying to get it increased. We think this will be the last increase that will be needed, and we know these times are hard. But it's in the absence of the federal Section 8, new federal Section 8 subsidies coming, it's one of the few programs that's able to reach low income. And the way that works is typically, first of all, it's an effective program in this way because the entire tax credit is passed through in rent reduction. So if someone gets a $1,000 tax credit, we can show you where there was a $1,000 rent reduction. So there's no bureaucracy that, you know, takes its slice off the top as far as the tax credit. There is a fee. Again, it's a self-supporting program. So that works from that standpoint. Another aspect of that program is we can deep skew the rents. I mean, so for example, if it's a 30-unit apartment building, we can take that entire tax credit associated with the entire 30-unit apartment complex and put take the entire tax credit and put it into 5 units so you can really buy down the rents. So that's a way that we can, without using the federal Section 8 subsidies or the RD federal subsidies, we are in Oregon able to get a few more units available to very low income. So it's been a very effective program in that regard.
Are we using that, Mr. Jones? Are we using that in the HOPE 6 project? Is that the kind of thing we're using?
My understand, I don't know that they will be using that in HOPE-6. I know they'll be using the federal tax credits in the HOPE-6, or at least that's their, they've at least expressed that they will be applying for the federal tax credits.
My concern now is because I think, and you can give, correct me if I'm wrong, we have 98% occupancy rate in North Northeast Portland. And if we have that high of an occupancy rate, what are we doing for helping those people, that 45% that is paying 30% of theirs, as well as that 10% that is paying at least 50% of their rent? You know, how effective, that's why I want to know about the incentives and the tax program to see if it's effective beyond Woodburn, but in places where it's the high rent district.
Senator George, Senator Carter, that is a huge issue. And again, I think I've described how the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit gets some of that down there. The 9% tax credits, and I was going to mention that too, you know, what those 9% tax credits do, the federal tax credits that I just said increased by 40%, they keep rents down, but they don't do an income comparison. So they don't say, you know what, you only make a couple hundred bucks, so you only have to pay $67 in rent. And well, all they do is they make sure that eligible low-income people are the target population. That's who's in the population. And they keep the rents down at a level that would be affordable if you made 60% of area median income or 50% of area median income. But if you make less than 60 or 50% of area median income, they don't say, oh, well, you even get a lower rent. So it's not as – that's why the preservation issue is so important for us, because you can't replicate that, those rent subsidized programs that are provided by HUD and the rural development. But it does keep rents down.
Mm-hmm. Boy, I guess I should probably wrap this up and skip some of this other stuff. I did want to though touch on farm worker housing, the interim, not last interim, but the interim before, there was a task force that looked at the issue of farm worker housing tax of farm worker issues in the state. Gene Arana and Bob Gusper are going to be up here later talking, and they have done an excellent job of integrating services with housing in our department. It's closer than it's ever been, and one of our strategic plan goals was to provide 200 units of farm worker housing and services. I forgot the number now, but we're on our way to do that. Our strategic plan, basically, we're hitting our goals in almost every area except the homeless program. It's growing beyond what we've been able to keep up with. But with ex-offender housing, we're going to exceed our 50 units. With preservation, we've far exceeded, almost doubled what we had projected we needed to do. Farm worker housing, we had talked about 200 units of housing with services provided. The thing about farm worker housing that to me was interesting is when I looked at reports that had been done in the 1950s, they essentially had the same problems that we were dealing with 4 or 5 years ago. At Gene's initiative, we went out and had the U of O help us with a farm worker housing services study to find out where are really the gaps in farm worker services. And Bob Gillespie and others have taken efforts to increase farm worker housing units provided. And that's an economic development tool as well. When you see large corporate farms getting fined or, you know, lawsuits that's costing them almost $100,000 or more because of inadequate farm worker housing, that's not their – I mean, in a way, that's not their job. It's part of their job perhaps, but we really can perhaps do – can assist anyway in providing farm worker housing. And we're trying a variety of approaches. The farm worker housing tax credit was increased last session from $3.3 million to $7.5 million, 30% of basis to 50% of basis. Lynn Parton and others went out, again, took the initiative, got out in the field, met with bankers, met with providers, and I'm happy to say that was fully subscribed for last year. So I think we're well on our way to achieving our goal of 200 units of farm worker housing with services. Again, I've talked a little bit about the OPUS project and at least what our long-term goals are, being able to tell you, you give us this, we'll deliver that, this program, these people started here and now they're at self-sufficiency. But I think I'll just stop there at that time to try and get a little bit caught up on progress. And I believe that Bob had mentioned the agenda? Is the committee administrator perhaps has the agenda, or am I wrong on that? Go ahead.
Mr. Chair.
We have a question from Representative Smith, and then we'll
Thank you, Chair George. Actually, two observations and perhaps recommendations. Let me begin by letting the committee know that I do have a potential conflict of interest.
Representative Smith, would you turn that mic up towards the board?
Especially with what I'm about to say. I do want the committee to know I do have a potential conflict of interest as a private developer. My company has worked with this department. With that said, two observations. Oregon Housing and Community Services, I believe, does a very, very good job, and your staff is extraordinarily capable, and so I do want you to know that. The two things I would hope over the coming biennium that we could continue to work on is, and I think I'm going to share this also with Economic and Community Development when they meet with us, is working to increase the application turnaround time. It's very frustrating for the private sector, especially in the lending community, to work with the state of Oregon when their turnaround times do not match up with those of the state, especially when private lenders are working with private investors, private developers, who have other constituencies that they're having to work with. And I think every time the state of Oregon can work to make it as seamless as possible, I think that's a good objective. And I was going through the goals, and I didn't see any reference to that, and I do think that's worthwhile. The other thing that, as the directors of Oregon Housing and Community Services, the one thing I would encourage is to help your employees to learn to say no. If a project doesn't look like it's going to be eligible, or you know the money isn't there, it's far more beneficial for lenders, for community developers, for investors to know that and just to hear it. I think so often there's such an interest in trying to help. Sometimes projects get carried down a path further than they should, and if we could just hear no right up front, it allows those private sector folks to say, okay, that's not an option, take it off the table, let's go somewhere else. So again, I compliment your department. I think you folks do a terrific job. Those are just observations, and I'll actually be sharing those with other folks as well.
Chair George, Representative Smith, thank you, and yep. Appreciate that.
Will Bill Carpenter be kind of addressing that here?
I think Bob Gillespie will talk briefly about some of the efforts that he is undergoing, the high performance agency thing, to streamline the application process for, again, I said we had a competitive process, so I think Bob will address that. Gillespie. Okay.
Representative Krieger?
If you go to page 15, the top where it talks about state economists project Oregon's economy, we turn around and grow faster than national average. That doesn't kind of line up with what we heard last Friday. In fact, probably we're looking at another 2 years of, we're lucky. In fact, I think those of us in Ways and Means, that were totally flat, we'd be happier than bird dog. We're scared it's going to go down. And then you also mentioned another time 129,000 people qualify for assistance that you don't reach. I just wondered if you had how much funds you have for that 129, that specifically.
Chair George, Representative Krieger, the 129,000 that I referred to are the people who are eligible for rent subsidies that we do not serve. So our other programs, as I was mentioning to Senator Carter, do provide some assistance to them, but in no way does it guarantee that they will be served to the level that the federal government believes is appropriate. So I think if we can keep their rents down, and I don't have the numbers on how many units we provide outside the Section 8, but I can get that for you, how many units of housing we provide that have rents, if you will, that are kept at affordable levels for different, I can get that information for you. I would assume that most of, or a good portion of that 129,000 people avail themselves of rental units that do have a control, if you will, on, or a cap, if you will, on the amount of rent. But it's probably a small dent in that 129,000 would be my guess. I think there's only so much we can do with the resources we have. But I'll get back to you on just how many units are in our portfolio that don't have rent assistance, but do have some form of rent cap.
Let me get that clear in my mind. In other words, even if you were able to contact, you know, line them up with program services, there's going to be no additional dollars, say, for example, flowing from the feds to take care of that problem?
Yes, Senator.
Kids going all different directions out there.
Well, if I understand your question, Senator George, there is help from the federal government as far as the tax credit that enables us to develop properties so that they can still still be solvent with lower rents, lower than market rents. So the federal tax credit keeps the market rent, keeps the rents below market, and they're still able to pay their bills. But it doesn't go in and look at their income and say, oh, you don't make very much money, you should be paying less than this. This is the rent. This is where it's at. You know, if you need to pay more than 30%, more than 50%, so be it. At least it's better than if you're paying market rent. So it's like the next best thing. So I wouldn't say the feds don't help at all, but they're not going to come in and say, I'm going to pay the difference so that you're going to be okay.
Just a request. You had a lot of short, to-the-point statistics in here. I only got a few of them. You know, we helped 29% with low-income housing and 129,000 that you're talking about, or our population grew 20% between certain time periods. And there were a number of others that I missed. Could you pull all of those out and give them to us in like a one-sheeter or something?
Senator, we need to get you closer to the mic.
Sorry.
Senator, could you state that so that we have that on record?
Mr. Binney had some statistics in his speech, mm-hmm. percentages and things like that, and I was just hoping we could get them all on a sheet of paper. Because I didn't get them all, very many of them down, and he selected them, I think, for the impact they would have, and they had them, but I'd like to look at them again.
Senator George,
I don't need all your cards, just a little.
Well, and it's all here, so okay. I'll get it gleaned out and put onto a one-pager for you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Rick Crager, Chief Financial Officer for the Department. I did pass out an agenda, as Mr. Repine had alluded to initially, that I passed to the committee assistant. Yeah, that's it. And wanted to let you know that we certainly are trying to squeeze everything into this two-day period. And we, at this point, are with Bob Gillespie and Gina Rana. They're going to start talking more on the program's overview that starts on page 25. So with that, I'm going to turn that over to them, and we'll try to get through that piece here this rest of the morning.
Okay.
Good morning.
Good morning. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Gillespie. I'm the administrator of the Housing Division. I guess when you get to go third, you pick up the pieces of what the others haven't already talked about. So much of what I was going to talk about has been mentioned, and I'll kind of go through my comments and try to give you the highlights of those. And particularly, I want to talk about the three different sections that we have within the Housing Division, which is the single family section, the housing finance section, and the housing resources section. And I want to briefly describe for you what their programs are and how we measure the performance of those programs so that we know that as an agency that we're doing a good job. The first section, the single family section that you've heard about, it has 4.25 FTE. And you saw a budget number earlier of $746 million for the next biennium. And that includes the loan repayments. In actuality, what the section will be doing during the next biennium is making new single-family loans through the proceeds of tax-exempt bond financing. And we're going to be targeting about $150 million in loan proceeds annually. And the key success to this program is our working relationship with lenders around the state. What we're doing is purchasing bonds, selling bonds, but we're purchasing loans that lenders have made around the state. And it's the ability of the small staff to work with lenders around the state so they have an expectation that if they make these low-interest loans, that we'll be there to purchase it and they can understand our programs. And it has been an ongoing successful program. We also have partners that help us with the mortgage insurance. Any loan that's over 8% loan-to-value needs to have mortgage insurance, and a lot of these partners are HUD, FHA insurance. Rural Development is a key partner, particularly in rural areas, with their loan insurance, we can actually do 100% loan to values. I believe that you folks have the performance measures that were passed on. I'm going to be referring to some of the pages in that. The first performance measure for the single family section, and all the performance measures relate to not only the volume of product that we're going to be producing, but also the number of units that are targeted towards different households. And with the single family section, and the $150 million in tax-exempt bond proceeds, what we want to do next year is to produce an additional 1,300 new single-family loans for the state of Oregon, and that's the volume number. We want to make sure that 15% of these are available to households that are at or below 100% of median income. And this is on page 6 of the booklet, if you have that in front of you. We'd like to see that additional 15% is to households that are at or below 90% of median income, with the balance of our new single-family loans, or 70% of them, to households that are at or below 80% of median income. And as you can see, that this is upping the trend of households that we're serving at lower incomes.
Senator Carter?
Can you give us a profile of the 80%? Is it mother, father, three kids, four kids? Give us a profile of that.
I would say that an 80% household would be a working household, moderate wage earners, and be like a family of two or three.
So if there are two or three in the family, and a moderate income would be $20,000 a year? If they had to change so much, I'm just... Because poverty levels have changed.
Right. Senator Carter, if I'm doing the math correctly in my head, I think it'd be about $26,000 a year.
Okay.
I hope the math is correct.
I just think that it gives us a better view of what we're talking about. Now, if you take that same poverty level and it's in Eastern Oregon and it's in my district, it's going to be a different impact.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in Gary Hansen and Margaret Carter district, you're going to have these people living in the inner city where rent is much higher, and that's why I keep going back to who is hungry in this state, and it's that typifies who is hungry, because they're basically in urban communities with incomes of that nature, and they're going to feel much, much harder than any other group of people, especially if they're living in urban Oregon.
Well, to continue reaching the lower income households for homeownership, we have multiple tactics, a couple of them that I want to comment on. One is regional housing centers that we're developing around the states, and I'll describe those more at a later time today or tomorrow. And the regional housing centers are multi-county organizations that provide multiple residential services, and so the citizens of Oregon don't have to shop from agency to agency to get the services. We've developed 5 of these already, and I hope to do another 6 in the next biennium. And they're an outreach arm for our single-family programs. We also have something called a program that we developed in this last biennium that's called the 24-month guarantee program. And the 24-month guarantee program was initiated with an allocation of carry-forward bond financing from the Private Activity Bond Committee. And last year we received $15 million in private activity volume cap. And we worked with our partners in Portland, the Portland Development Center, and the Portland Housing Center to set up a program whereby households that aren't credit worthy at this time, they don't have good credit ratings or they don't have good household financing, those partners in Portland are going to be working with those households over a 2-year period to make them credit worthy. And what we're willing to do is to guarantee that interest rate that we have today, that 4.95% interest rate, for a period of 2 years while these households end up becoming qualified borrowers. That program, when we rolled it out at the end of last year, was subscribed in a matter of months. We had already enough people on the list signing up to enroll in the programs to try to access the affordable financing. This year we went back to the private activity committee and we got an additional $40 million in volume cap, and we're using that to go statewide with this program. And we'll go back to Portland with PDC and the Portland Housing Center, but also we're going to work with housing authorities around the state that have family self-sufficiency programs that has a goal of providing homeownership, and also with our regional housing centers. The single family section also has something called the homeownership assistance account, which is budgeted at $776,000 for this biennium. These are general revenue funds. And the homeownership assistance program directly targets the impediments towards affordable homeownership. The first is a down payment assistance program. This is one of the largest impediments for lower income households in acquiring a home is the down payment. And we run this program through our partners at the Oregon Bankers Association, the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association. They administer the program for us free of charge. And we put $300,000 a biennium into this program, and we provide $1,500 in down payment assistance, and we require that that be matched by at least $500. In reality, it's matched for every dollar we put in, there's six other dollars that are going in. So it's operated for free, and it has incredibly high leverage. The second program that we're running through the homeownership assistance account is the homebuyer education program, and this too addresses one of the greatest impediments, is getting people to be credit worthy. And we have a well-developed curriculum called ABCs of Home Buying. There's a statewide collaborative of home buyer educators that are made up of lenders and local nonprofit partners. And we fund the collaborative and the trainers with $160,000 for biennium. And on an annual basis, they're training or teaching the ABCs of home buyers to over 2,000 households annually. And that relates to our second performance objective. If you, I see some of you are looking at it on page 9. And that's that we want to see the 1,300 loans that we're making on an annual basis, that 20% of these loans will be to persons that have actually completed the ABCs of home buying. And I think the Home 24 program that we're doing and the regional housing centers will make that an obtainable goal, because it is quite a jump for us from what we have done in the past. The second section within the housing division is the housing finance section. It has 5.25 FTE. And this section is making multifamily loans through the sale of tax-exempt bond proceeds. And the amount of bond sales we're budgeting for this section for the next year will be $100 million in bond sales, and it's to provide housing for households that are at or below 60% of median income. There's three core lending programs in the housing finance section. The first is the elderly and disabled loan program, which are not only tax-exempt bonds, but they're also general obligation bonds of the state. It can house every... Yes?
Excuse me, do you have your page numbers as you're going through? We were on 13 just a minute ago.
When I refer to the page numbers, I'm referring to the performance objectives, so I'll call those up.
Okay.
My comments are just right here.
Okay, all right.
The elderly and disabled loan program, as I was saying, is one of the key lending programs. It houses everything from frail elderly to elderly independent persons. The second lending program is called the Risk Share Program. And as the name implies, this is a program where we're actually sharing the risk of the mortgage insurance, and in this case, it's with HUD FHA insurance. And this has been a very successful program for us. In 2001, we as a department did 18% of the nation's business. We're actually, Oregon is only 1% of the population. So it's been a very successful program to us. And to Senator Duke's question earlier, these two programs are two of the key programs in preserving the existing federally financed properties. And Jack was pretty close on the numbers that we've actually preserved. We've sold bonds or closed loans on 7 in this biennium, where our strategic objective was to do 5. And we have 6 additional applications that are in the underwriting process right now. And I think the that when I added up the total number of project-based assistance, you know, the federal money that's coming in and helping the tenants pay their rents, there's 545 households that will receive federal assistance because of the preservation of those 13 projects. And you really don't know how much the assistance is, but I made an assumption that it's $300 a household per month, which is a pretty reasonable assumption. And that means on an annual basis that those 13 projects will bring to the state $1,800,000 in rental assistance. So they really are important to preserve. And the risk share program and the elderly and disabled program are two of the key programs to preserving that existing housing. We've also seen for larger transactions in this biennium that there's a program that the market is moving toward. It's called pass-through revenue bond financing, which is otherwise known as conduit financing. And we developed a conduit loan program during this biennium. And what we're doing there is actually issuing tax-exempt bonding authority to our partners, and then they are in turn the trustees that we're issuing this to are actually to become the lenders on these developments. We provide the tax credits that go along with the development, so we become a one-stop lender for the people that are looking for both the issuance of the tax-exempt authority and also the 4% credits. We have, in this biennium alone, having just developed this program, we've financed 396 units at a value of $24.7 million, and we have an additional 946 units that are 946 units for $52.5 million that are currently underwriting. And this is one of our conduit financing projects. No, it isn't. You fooled me. You said it was Troutdale, but that's actually Corvallis. That's a tax credit project in Corvallis.
That's a what now?
A tax credit project.
Oh, tax credit. Okay.
Yeah. The third section is the housing resources section, and this section has some of the programs that Jack was referring to, the low-income housing tax credits and the trust fund dollars. The section deals entirely with grants and tax incentives. It has 12 and three-quarter employees, and we have... And this is where one of the programs where we really outreach to our partners. Our partners are for-profit partners. They're the local community development corporations and local community action agencies and local housing authorities, as well as sometimes social service providers. And our partners, when we're using these grants and tax incentives in the housing resources section, are also equity investors that are buying the credits. We also have local lenders that are lending on the projects. And a lot of times we have local communities that are also putting their resources into the developments. And the tax credits you've already heard about, the low-income housing tax credits, that was the program that Jack was saying we had the 40% increase in. If you look at the total amount of resources that we get from that federal program, it brings about $48 million in equity annually for the development of affordable housing. The second program that we have available is called the Home Investment Partnership Program, which is another, we shorten it, we call it the HOME Program. This is authorized by HUD, and with this program we get about $11.6 million annually that we put out in the form of grants. It's one of the more complicated programs to deal with. The tax credits are because the rules are written by the IRS. In this case, the rules are written by HUD. And they've had years to develop something that we call overlay requirements. The Uniform Relocation Act, the Davis-Bacon Act, the Environmental Policy Act, all these overlay requirements that if we don't meet these properly as the department, we expend the home funds and it's found out later that we haven't met these overlay requirements, and technically we can owe the money back to HUD. And
Senator Morris?
Sure. On page 28, it references $16.1 million, and I thought I heard you reference 11-something million.
That's correct.
What are the balance of those funds used for?
There's two answers to that question, and I gave you updated figures. We just got our new annual allocation from HUD, and and the amount of home funds have gone up, and that was an annual figure of $11.6 million. And the figure that you're looking at in your booklet was the figure for the biennium.
So that would be 11 times 2. So this figure will be adjusted.
That's correct. And everybody keeps whispering the second part of the answer to me. Senator Morris, we don't use all of the money for rental housing development. A good portion of the funds goes into addressing the problems that we've been talking about today in the form of rental assistance. The home program can put out to the non-entitled areas of the state tenant-based assistance, where we're helping those households, that 129,000 households who are income or rent burdened. We can use the home funds to assist them with their monthly rental payments. And right now, I believe we're using $2 million annually to help households with their rental assistance. And actually, we're one of the few states, there's like two or three states that have chosen to use the home program for their purposes. So that's where the discrepancy came up in the budget figures there. But we will update the budget to reflect the just recently released budget for the state. I was talking about the complexities of the home program and the overlay requirements. We have, in our policy option packages, we are asking for a position to administer the home program in its entirety. We currently have been paying someone work out of class to do that duties and others, and we want to have someone who concentrates solely on the home program and those overlay requirements to make sure that we're not creating department liabilities in the way of potentially having to repay the funds back to HUD. The third grant program is the trust fund that I think we've talked about. It is budgeted about $8.5 million for this biennium. It's targeted towards households that are at or below 50% of the area median income. This funding source is often essential to developments, and compared to what the federal government has given us in the way of regulations, I got to say that the trust fund is a program that is a great program to utilize. It's often dollars that go into a development first so that the sponsors can meet those requirements of plans, bids, and specs, and environmental studies in order to access the more complicated tax credits or home funds, or for that matter, the construction or permanent lenders. The trust fund is also important to special needs populations where they have very little or no income. Because of that, you can handle no debt service on the project, and it has to be all grant subsidies in order to develop the units and make them feasible. The fourth program that we spoke about earlier is the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit, and this provides the ability to, in working in partnership with lenders, to make loans that are 4% below the market rate for the given loans. And we were able to do about $12.5 million in loans on an annual basis with the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credits. And this program is unique to Oregon. Other states that have tried to create a state tax credit program emulate the federal tax credit program, and what they end up doing is getting about 50% of the money back from the tax credits in actual equity to the project. And it runs at a much lower efficiency than the federal low-income housing tax credit program. I think our program is very efficient because 100% of the savings due to the lower interest rate has to be passed through in lower rents. And Jack was alluding to earlier that you can also take that savings due to the lower interest rate and you can pass it through as a block or to a block of units so that you can actually take the rent of those units and skew them way down. So you could be taking care of the households who are really rent burdened or the special needs populations. The final program we have is the HELP program, which is was done through the refinancing of some federal bonds, and it's $400,000 a year and is targeted towards either farm workers, homeless, or victims of domestic violence. We have two performance measures for the Housing Resources section. The first one is on page 15 of the performance measure packet. And again, as with the other performance measures, we're targeting both the volume that we're producing and the incomes that we're wanting to meet. And the total target in annual production with the resources that I've just gone through for the housing resources section is 950 units on an annual basis, and 35% of those would be for households that are less than 60%. Another 35% would be for households at or below 50% of the area median income. Then 13% would be for households 40% below area median income, with the balance, the 10%, being at or below 30% of median income. And if some of you are like me and you add it up and you say, well, that's not 100%, that's because some of the units are actually above market. And in instances, it's good to have mixed income projects. You get more of a balance of the tenancy, and the higher income units pay a higher rent, and it can actually help subsidize the operations of the lower rent units that maybe not be carrying the operational expenses of the development. So that's why the numbers don't necessarily add up to 100%. Both the housing finance section and the housing resources section relate to the next performance goal, which is listed on page 20. And that's that we want to see of the total production of both the housing finance and the housing resources section, that we have 50% of the units be targeted towards households with special needs. And the special needs can be elderly or disabled populations or persons recovering from mental illnesses or alcohol and drug addictions. And that total would be 727 units for this biennium. There was some mention earlier about the consolidated funding cycle. The consolidated funding cycle is a competitive application process that we have twice a year for all the resources in the housing resources section, the tax credits and the home funds and the trust fund dollars. And this application is, we were probably one of the first in the nation to develop an application that married all the resources together, which, to Representative Smith's comments, we used to punish people by making them apply for the trust fund and then apply for the tax credits, and every one of those became like a cliff issue, that if you didn't get that one, then you fell off the cliff and the project couldn't go forward. Because the consolidated funding cycle is competitive, and it's as I said, oversubscribed 2 to 3 times, we lay out some rather rigorous priorities for people that are applying to the consolidated funding cycle. We want to make sure that when we're providing these grants and tax incentives, that we're making a difference in the communities around the state of Oregon, that we want to target needs that aren't being met in the current local market, and that's based on the incomes and the populations that are being served. We want to have housing units that are 10 to 20% below the given market or lower, and serve populations that aren't currently being served. There, Jack was talking about some of the department's strategic initiatives. One that he didn't mention is that we wanted to provide housing for persons that are in an ongoing program of recovery, which we call alcohol and drug-free housing. Last biennium, we received $1 million from the Department of Human Services that we put into our consolidated funding cycle and married it with our resources and leveraged that $1 million that they gave us into 116 units of housing for persons that are in an ongoing program of recovery. In this biennium, to date, we have taken an additional $1 million and put it into our funding cycle and have produced 110 units of alcohol and drug-free housing. We also had a strategic objective to produce 200 units of farm worker housing, and to date, with one funding cycle to go, we have produced 149 units of farm worker housing, and I believe that puts us on target to complete that objective. And then Jack also mentioned the strategic objective for ex-offender housing, and the goal was to produce 50 units of ex-offender housing, and to date we have funded 86 units of ex-offender housing. And my final comment would be that in the housing division, in my description of it, I'd say that we have two architects that are incredibly hardworking individuals that are looking at an excess of 150 plans per biennium. And they play a critical role for us because they're looking at the plans to make sure that if we're lending on the product, that we have good assets that we're lending on that will be protected over time. They're also looking at to make sure that they function for the population that they're serving, that the elderly should be appropriate for the elderly or family should be appropriate for family housing. And finally, as we're doing more of the preservation projects, we're acquiring properties that need to be repaired and rehabilitated. And one of the critical functions is to develop a scope of work that is going to make that project usable for the new period of affordability. And of the two architectural positions, one of them is an FTE, and the other one is of limited duration. And in our policy option packages, we are requesting that the second architectural position also become an FTE. So that was my abridged comments. I'd be happy to answer any other comments.
We have a question from Senator Dukes, and then we have some encouragement from Senator Carter that we have a little break before we go to the floor in just a few minutes. So with that, we'll go ahead and end, and we'll start again tomorrow.
I just had some questions about the goals, I guess. Well, I'm starting on 6. And noticing drops. Number of single-family home loans closed at Hargan is 1,300, which is the lowest in any of the periods you're giving us except for 1998. And then I dropped down to 81 to 90% of applicable medium income. And again, it's lower than anything except 98. 98 must have been a bad year. And I was just curious, is this reflecting the recession we're in? Is it reflecting that we're meeting our goals, previous goals, so we don't need to target those as much? Just curious as to why, because there was actually one more down here under performance measurement, 81 to 90% of applicable medium income. The 15% was down.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, I think there's two answers to that question. And the first is the inflationary cost of the housing units that is taking more of our bond proceeds to acquire a fewer number of single-family residential units. As the cost goes up, then our resources aren't going up in a correspondingly amount in order to purchase additional units. So I think that's part of why we see the numbers dropping. And the second thing is we play a balance between there's only so much tax-exempt bonding authority in the state of Oregon. We're allocated in the bond bill actually $116 million. And if you add up what the single-family section does on an annual basis and what the multifamily section does, we far exceed that. But it's because we have been strategically buying volume cap that's been returned from the State Veterans Department, and we get the private activity carry forward when we can. But as we look into the future and we look at the balance and the competing demands on tax-exempt bond financing, we are targeting specifically that we have $150 million for the single-family programs and $100 million for the multifamily tax-exempt programs.
Let me ask this then. Are we specifically targeting the 91 to 100% medium income and instead of the 81 to 90%? Because those numbers of the higher income level have gone up and the others have gone down. The percentage, the target that we're after for the next biennium.
Well, as I'm looking at, I see they have actually gone up.
And you can check that out.
I will check that out.
I don't want to keep people here a lot longer. I just had one more, and it was back on page 20. And I was looking under the special needs detail and noticing that for the last couple of years, we've zeroed out the domestic violence. And I'm hoping that means that we have what we need for victims in the way of housing for victims of domestic violence, and not that we're choosing not to go there. So,
Mr. Chair, Senator Deuce, I believe we definitely would not choose to go there. I would say there's two answers to that. One is that service dollars to run the domestic violence shelters, you also need to have those in conjunction with it. I believe that I've heard from some of our sponsors that those are in short supply, and I And I've heard from the folks at Economic Development that can also fund domestic violence shelters with the Community Development Block Grant Funds, that they feel that there is a pretty good supply of those around the state, and that would be the extent of what...
But you'll check that all out.
I'll check that out for you.
Because it just looks a little strange to see it 0% as a target there.
Okay, one question I have is, could you help us to get a grasp? You mentioned overlays that the federal government may be requiring. They're going to add costs. Issues like with the project that you're doing, are you paying the local system development charges and other things such as land costs? They're adding to construction costs, because I think that's an interesting question, is why we'd be going down if we have the same amount of money. With that, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 5029, and with tap the gavel, we will be adjourned.